A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T. Well, hello, and a fine morning to you, or afternoon, or evening, or middle of the night, if that's where I happen to find you. Hope you enjoyed your St. Patrick's Day, and I hope that this recording finds you well here. Well into 2017, it's spring, at least in Colorado. Hopefully, it's spring where you are. And we are looking to have the least snowy March on record, or we were, except that there might be some snow here in the next 7 to 10 days. So I guess we'll see. Just in time for my mother to come visit and get away from the snow and rain in Oregon. Anyway, you didn't tune in to hear me talk about spring in Colorado. You tuned in to hear me talk about nuclear waste. I don't know what you tuned in for, but I'm thankful you're here. Don't have much of a rant to start off. More quiet encouragement. I was just something I've been thinking about. I have a friend, someone whom I love, have known for a couple of years now, and she and I talk occasionally. And I would say that she's living a very small life. The things that she spends her passion on, that she spills her passion on, like Japanese anime, very passionate about that. She has a garden, and she will talk for hours about her garden and other things in her life, and her Facebook page is full of, oh, look at these beautiful horses, and look at these beautiful flowers, and political rants, and all sorts of things. But And allow me to say, please, there is nothing wrong with being a fan of gardens or horses or ranting about political things. But in terms of this particular person, it's kind of all she has. You scratch at the surface and get past the horses and the garden and the these are the places I wish I could go on vacation. And there's nothing underneath. I'm being vague on the off chance that she would ever hear this podcast. It's not likely, because she is a very self-centered person, and unless she knew I was doing a podcast about her, there's little chance that she would bother to stop and listen to this, because it was not about her. She doesn't really care all that much. We talked recently, just, you know, brief thing in passing, and it just, I keep thinking about where she's living, and there's a lot of struggle. I know enough about her life. A lot of childhood stuff, a lot of difficulties with a mother who she felt like never loved her. To this day, she still lives with her mom, and feels like mom just apparently mom has never said "I love you." More, "You're a burden to me." And you know, there's, I understand that life can be very difficult, but what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that this friend is not willing to trust God because of the way, how she was raised and what she has seen in terms of parents. I've been told, and I think it's true, that everybody relates to God the way they relate to their father or to their parents, in this case. And I get it. I get it. If she thinks, well, I can't trust God because look how I was treated by my earthly parents, he must be far worse. I get it, but I pity her. I do, because while she retains ownership of her kingdom is very, very small. She lives in a little box, emotionally and spiritually, and she's got the box all, you know, set up like she likes it. She's got curtains on the windows, and she's picked the carpet out, and she plays just the music she wants in her mental and emotional and spiritual box, but it's still a cage. She tries to ignore the bars on the windows and feels safe because nobody can get at her. And A, that's not true. And two, she's far too easily satisfied. That's really what I want to get at. It's a C.S. Lewis quote that I've probably mentioned on this podcast before, but it's worth telling again. He talks about in, I want to say it's The Four Loves, maybe Mere Christianity, but it's definitely C.S. Lewis. He's talking about what we settle for. And he's like, he describes it as a child who sits on the ground making mud pies, who cannot imagine the pleasures of a holiday at the sea. And then he goes on to say, we are far too easily satisfied. And my friend, whom I refer to vaguely, she is not the only one I know who is far too easily satisfied, who is the king of her own little kingdom. And even if, and I'm honestly not certain, even if a person can, you know, if confessing that Jesus Christ is Lord and believing with your heart that God raised him from the dead is tantamount to fire insurance, and a person could then really have little else to do in relationship with God the rest of their life but enjoy eternity in his presence, then my friend has her fire insurance taken care of, and, you know, she's got eternity is worked out. But, and if that is true, because there are verses in the Bible that talk about people saying, wait a minute, God, we were close, we were buds. The verse that I'm thinking of specifically, many will say to me on that day, the one of judgment, Lord, Lord, didn't we cast out demons in your name? Did we not heal the sick? And he will say to them, depart from me, I didn't know you. There are those, and some may hear these words, who think you are good with God, but have retained ownership of your kingdom, and, well, those who are their own kings get to be their own kings through eternity. I don't know what hell is really going to look like, but I am certain that it is separation from God. And there are those that think, well, separation from God, fantastic, I don't want to have anything to do with him. Maybe think a little harder when we say separation from God. God is love, so you're not just separated from your possible perception of the bearded guy throwing thunderbolts. You're separated from all things that are good. Color, flavor, music, love, anything that is good is from God, and hell is separation from all of that. But you get to retain control. You get to be king. You get to do what you want. Your options may be very limited, but you won't have to answer to anybody. That's hell. Hell is, I don't have to answer to anybody. And you take the idea of that to its extreme, you know, someone who wants to be in charge, wants to be in control, wants all things subject to them, you keep going with that, and the end of that road is someone who will not do anything for anyone else, who cares not for anyone else. I've heard one description of hell, it's like there are bowls of food everywhere, but instead of arms, everyone has 2-foot spoons for arms. And so everyone would be fed if everyone fed everyone else. But I'm not describing this well. That everyone has 2-foot-long spoons for arms, there's bowls of food everywhere, and everyone is starving. Because no one would think to feed someone else. They are only and always concerned about themselves. And my friend with her gardens and her horses, she's not without hope. She's not, like, to a sociopathic level, but her life does revolve around her. And most of her decisions involve what's best for me, possibly on an unconscious level. But if she keeps going, if that becomes the pattern, it becomes easier and easier and easier as one goes along for her whole life just to be about what is best for me. And that's the road that leads to hell. For those that are still listening, anybody still with me on this? Anyway, there's one more thing that I want to share. This is just me, but I feel it's scripturally sound. I feel it's, if you actually apply this, I think you'll have good results. It's my secret to life. And I was talking to the 5th and 6th grade boys. We separated into small groups on Sunday, and I had 6 or 7 of them, and I got to talk to them, and we had been talking about Ecclesiastes. That was the lesson on Sunday, and how Solomon, if it was Solomon, whoever wrote Ecclesiastes, had tried everything, had all, you know, make a list of all the things you wish you could have if you had $1 billion. He had all of them. Never had indoor plumbing, but didn't know what he was missing. So he had everything. He had tried everything. He had done everything. And the writer says in Ecclesiastes, it was all meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing satisfied. And that is not just true for this guy. It's a truth, much like sowing and reaping. There is a place inside of us that only God can satisfy. And whether or not you believe in God, whether or not you acknowledge God, doesn't change the fact. You don't have to believe in sowing and reaping either. But if you put corn in the ground, corn will come up. No one ever planted corn and got tomatoes. So in the same way, there is a place inside that only God can satisfy. And you can fill it with whatever you want. But if riches satisfied, rich people would be a lot happier. And I can think of quite a few that are not. If love satisfied, I know a lot of people that are very loved and still are searching. I myself feel very loved. I'm in a wonderful marriage. I have a wonderful family. But I'll be the first to admit, there is something that still, it is not enough. And going back to my boy C.S. Lewis again, he has said, and I'm probably going to butcher the quote a little bit, the presence of a feeling, of a sense of something that cannot be satisfied in our life is a strong indication that there is something more beyond this life. To put another way, the very fact that we're looking for something more and that nothing we can find ever quite does it, it's logical to conclude that there is something more. And that something more is God. And I'm going to assume that those that are still listening are at least with me that there is a God. And the analogy I gave the boys on Sunday, I told them, pretend you're playing the game of life. And so those that play the game of life, you have a car, you're in control of the car. Well, everyone on this earth has a quote-unquote car, or boat, or horse, or whatever, has some sort of method of transportation, and they have a road that they are following. Everybody has a road they're going down. And I use the car because it helps with the analogy. A lot of people don't acknowledge God at all. They don't think he exists. They don't think he's reachable. They just ignore God, and so he is not in the car. Then there are plenty of people for whom God is in the trunk. He's there in case of emergency. You know, I don't keep windshield wiper fluid sitting on the passenger seat. I don't keep jumper cables on the passenger seat. I put them in the trunk. The spare tire, not sitting, you know, in my lap as I drive. Of course not. It's in the trunk. It's there when I need it, when I'm in trouble. Otherwise, I ignore it. I do not think about the spare tire 99.99% of the time that I'm driving. But that 0.1%, see, I'm screwing myself over with my own math, that small percentage of the time when suddenly I need a spare tire becomes very important. Plenty of people have God in the trunk, and they just grab for him in case of emergency, or to, you know, rail at him when life goes wrong, and they say, why did you do this to me? Then there are those who have God, they're who are wiser than the trunk people. They have God in the back seat. He can kick the driver's seat occasionally to get the driver's attention. He might say, hey, you're going too fast, or oh, looks like a cop ahead. He might offer some suggestions, but basically he's still just along for the ride. But, you know, if he's in the back seat, at least he is part of the group. And, you know, someone in the back seat can offer an opinion, can be asked their opinion. They at least get to contribute. Then there are those who are a little wiser, and they have God in the front passenger seat, and they've given him the map. And they've turned over control of where they go. Maybe they think they do. These people generally, they might want God to kind of tell them, all right, you know, when's the next exit? How far to the next town? You know, you've got the map. But they're still in charge of where they're going. It's not, okay, God, I'm just driving. You tell me what the next turn is. It's, okay, we're trying to get to Denver. How many miles to Denver? What's the next turn? Where would you like to stop and eat? Still wiser than the back seat and far wiser than having him in the trunk. But a lot of people, that's as far as they go. And my friend with her gardens and her horses, oh, sheesh. he's hardly even in the trunk. I guess he's in the trunk of her life's car, but she rarely acknowledges him because, as I've said, she is in charge. She is very much king of her little kingdom. And so what I told the boys, not saying anything about my friend, I was just using the analogy of the car. I was like, okay, here's the secret to life. you really want to have fulfillment, you really want to have joy, you really want to have a life that means something, give him the keys. That is the secret, ladies and gentlemen. And maybe not much of a secret, and yet it is a very difficult thing to do. But I swear to you, by all that I understand in this world, and I like to think that after almost 40 years, I understand a couple of things. The best thing I ever did, and it's about 17 years ago now, was giving God the keys to my life. And when I say give him the keys, I mean trading seats. He is in the driver's seat. He is in charge of whether we're moving at all, how fast we go, where we go, when we stop, what, you know, everything. I am allowed to offer suggestion, and sometimes I, you know, try to take the wheel. But by and large, and I'm not being facetious as I talk about this, as much as I understand how to do this, and I regularly ask God to help me if there's any areas of my life I haven't turned over to him, everything is in his control, including the relationship with my friend the gardener, who is very difficult to talk to because she always talks and never listens. And every time we do have a conversation, I have to kind of endure it because I'm like, am I even going to be able to get a word in edgewise? Do my words even matter to her? And the way our conversations go, she kind of treats me like they don't. I think not because she doesn't care about me, but because she cares far more about herself and doesn't even think that I might be affected. And so, in this relationship, I would far prefer to walk away. But I am her friend because God pointed her out one day and said she needs a friend. She needs someone to listen to her. And so I do. And I will continue to do so until she walks away or until God says that's sufficient, that's enough, you can stop. Because God is in charge. What I do with my time, my money, my relationships, my anything, fill in the blank, it's all in God's hands. And I will tell you that the last 17 years, here's the thing. I said, you know, give him the keys and you will experience adventure. And that is true. Give him the keys and you will you have the opportunity for more fulfillment, more peace, more joy, a life, a bigger life than you can ever know inside the little kingdom, that little jail cell kingdom I described earlier. This is all true. However, a bit of a caveat. If you do this, please know that it may not be fun. God, the road God has said, here's where we're going. I have gone down roads that I would never have voluntarily walked in a spiritual sense. I have gone up vertical cliff faces that I would not voluntarily have climbed if I hadn't given him control. But at the same time, every step has been worth it. It has been all worth it. And I would go through it again. I would go through it again on fire if I had to, because 17 years ago, I was so broken and so lost and so alone. And God doesn't love me more now than he did 17 years ago, or for that matter, 37 years ago. But I love him more now, and I love myself more now, and I'm more available to love others. And I was living, here's the thing, I keep talking about this, or earlier I was talking about this small jail cell of a kingdom my gardening friend has. I was living in a cell just as small. I had no friends. I had few ambitions, and the ambitions I had were, if I can do this, I'll feel good about myself, which is no way to go through life. And God saved me from myself. Now, the fire insurance part of Jesus Christ as Lord, I did that when I was 4, and if I had died, you know, the horse that took off under me when I was 6, if I'd been killed in that experience, I believe, you know, I would have enjoyed the reward that is still ahead of me. But, or if when I was a stupid 18-year-old and driving like an idiot, I'd somehow crashed and killed myself, I would have gone, I believe, to eternity with God and not eternity without. But there was so much more to life that I was not experiencing. And there is so much more to life than my gardening friend is experiencing. And the more she goes on, here's the thing. Entropy is real. If, you know, if you don't keep spinning a top, sooner or later it comes to a stop. If you don't keep tilling a field, sooner or later the plants die. Or watering a field, sooner or later the plants die. You can't just leave a thing alone and expect it's going to be just fine. Dust gathers, food rots, that things are constantly trying to go from being in a good state to being in a bad state, if you will. And it's so much easier. It is hard to keep the house clean. It would be easier to just let things keep getting dirtier. I have to work at it. And if a person is not working at life, my gardening friend, in the couple years that I've known her, is not getting any less arrogant, any less full of herself. It's getting worse. And now she's kind of talking about stepping away from the church, stepping away from God. It's like, I'm not sure I even believe this anymore. And I'm glad of it on one hand, because she's just been messing around with Christianity. She's just been kind of, playing little Christian games. So her being real and honest with herself and everyone else is fantastic. But if she gives herself the right to do as she pleases, it's just going to get worse. It's not going to get better. She's not going to get more compassionate, more loving. She's not going to suddenly start listening to people. It's going to get worse. And then the kingdom gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and it gets harder and harder. The heart gets harder and harder to break out. So, for her sake, I pray for her, because she can't keep me from doing that. And I pray that God wakes her up like he woke me up. And he had to smack me upside the head to do it, but I will be forever thankful that he did, that he loved me that much to save me from myself. So, like I said, it wasn't a rant, but that's what I'm thinking about today. And I appreciate being able to tell it to you nice folks, and hopefully you have still listened. So, a bit of transitional music, and then we're going to get to the actual point of today's podcast. All right, so, like I promised, I think I said last week, we are going to take a break from nitpicking for a little while and do something special. Here is the something special. I, as I probably have talked about before, spent from age 10 to age 30 trying to become a published author. And I've wrote a whole bunch of books. Actual, finished, this is a novel from beginning to end, and I could see maybe somebody wanting to at least read it. Between 7 and 9, depending on how generous I'm being with the term novel, we'll call it 9 books that I've written. Every one of those 9 has been written at least twice. And I'll talk more about my writing process next time, because we're already 20 minutes into this podcast. But suffice to say that we are going to read together a book that I rewrote in 2000. 17 years ago, and it's fun. I didn't choose this book to go along with what I was just talking about earlier, but they are very related, because I started rewriting this book in July of 2000, and the day I started working on it was within a week or two of that time period where God stepped in and said, all right, we're going to start a new journey. So it was the very beginning of my new life, really. Because the person I was before God smacked me and the person I was after are two very different people. I was not alive before. And so giving him the keys was the first day of a new life, and this was the first book I wrote, and it was a rewrite. But in that new life, it's not the latest book I've written, and I wouldn't say that it's necessarily the best one I've written, but it's the one we're going to read. And the reason why I picked it is partially because the one I did most recently, I want to let sit for a while before I go back to it. Let me back up. The reason why I'm doing any of this is I have a friend whose name is Joy Copeland. Name drop, boom! She and her husband and their 3 boys are working on getting to Ireland to be missionaries. And she writes books. And she published her book on Amazon, and I recently had the opportunity to read one of her novels and was just chatting with her about how do you do this? Not how do you do this. I'd like to think that after 20 years of trying, I know a little bit about the publishing process. But since I haven't done much of anything in terms of writing in the last 7 or 8 years, things have drastically changed. And the last time I had a novel I was shopping around, I wasn't really thinking about self-publishing. And when I did self-publish the 5 nitpicking books, like 4 or 5 years ago, and in that time a lot of things have changed. Apparently it's a lot easier to self-publish. You don't have to go through another company, which is nice, because Essential 10 Limited was so limited that they closed their doors like 18 months after they publish my books. So I am thinking the next time I need a project, as though running a business and raising a child and keeping house isn't enough to do, and recording podcasts every couple of weeks and ministering to kids on Sundays, next time I need a project, need something to do, I would like to go through the books that, you know, one or more of these 9 books and edit them, see what I can do to tweak them, make them better, and then put them on Amazon. So that I can, A, get a physical copy printed. Apparently that's not as hard as it used to be either, because I would like to just, you know, on my bookshelf say, boom, this is a book that I wrote. Whether it's just the only copy in existence or not, I would just like for that to be a thing. And to put it out on Amazon, just so it's out there in the world. The book that I'm sitting holding in my lap right now, I spent hundreds of hours writing it, well, probably the first time, and many, many more hours writing it the second time. I've put a lot of my soul into this, and one or two people has ever read it. Those that were kind enough to say, sure, you've got a book, I will read your manuscript. And I wish I could thank them by name. It's 17 years ago, so I don't remember who did, but thank you. If any of this seems familiar to you, then write me, email me, hit me up on Facebook so that I can thank you in person. But anyway, that's why I'm reading this book, and what book it is, it's called The Kid. Not to be confused with the Disney movie by the same name. The Kid, it's a book about a baseball team in the 1930s, and about a young man on that baseball team. And the part that I'm kind of excited about is, because I wrote it 17 years ago, good Lord, I remember the basic premise. I remember, you know, what I was after, but I can guarantee that there are scenes, there are probably entire characters I don't remember. I'll be like, oh my gosh, I forgot about this guy entirely. Or I wrote this? So that's kind of fun for me. I don't have the best memory in the world, and I have very little memory of this book as a whole. So we're kind of going to experience it together for the first time, even though I wrote it. And that's just fun. I'm excited about this. So 100,000 words, more than 200 pages. I'm not sure how fast it's going to go, but I am very sure this is going to be a multi-podcast kind of reading. We're not going to get very far this first time, especially since I've used up almost 30 minutes of podcast with other things. So that's what we're going to do. And I may talk more about my writing process next time. Who knows? But right now, without much in the way of further ado, The Kid, by, at that time, Chip Nestle. Begun in July of 2000, completed in December of 2000. Prologue. The young lady was easily the most beautiful woman on the train station platform, and most of the men that noticed her would have been willing to admit her the most beautiful woman they might have ever seen. Black flats set off an ankle-length and darkly red dress, but her outfit, though striking, was instantly forgotten when one saw her face. Her deep green eyes were excellently contrasted by long, chestnut-brown hair that shifted from one shoulder to the other as she stepped and dodged and even pushed her way down the wooden slats that bordered the train. It looked as if the beautiful woman had been crying, and most of the men that saw her would have been more than willing to ask her if anything was wrong. But she was searching faces. She was looking for someone in particular, and though her green eyes took in every man there, few even managed a smile before she had moved past, before she was gone, in a whirl of dark red skirts and a brown suitcase. The beautiful woman was worried and scared. The wooden platform was very large, but she had searched her way from one end almost to the other, and he wasn't there. Every face after face was another face that wasn't his, and if she couldn't find him... Someone else on the platform was searching, but not silently. A tall man with the face the color of her dress, far back the way the beautiful woman had come, was looking over the crowd and calling for the person he sought. He was obviously connected to the beautiful woman by the way she stiffened when she heard his voice. She knew if she looked back that the man would be wearing horn-rimmed glasses underneath a shock of dark hair streaked with gray, but there was no need to look back. Rather, she looked harder and moved faster, resisting the urge to scream, to stamp her foot, to hit someone or something out of frustration because she wasn't like that anymore. She was trusting in her Lord now. and the man she searched for, he had also said that she didn't have to do such things. And she wanted so badly for them both to be right, and for his face to be one of the faces she saw, but he wasn't there. She couldn't find him, and the platform was almost finished, the train was about to leave, and the horn-rimmed glasses were getting closer, and despite being easily the most beautiful woman on the train station platform, she was out of time and beyond hope.
I raised you a dollar.
A dollar?
You must have a lot of faith in that hand, Triplehorn. Watch and learn, Pickens.
Looking across his cards, Bud dares the man to match him or raise the stakes. Pickens looks at his cards and then lets them fall face down onto the table, muttering. Dutch Catan taps his own cards on the tabletop, looking straight across and meeting Bud's eyes.
I'm fairly sure you're bluffing, Mr. Famous Pitcher, so I'll just see your dollar and take my chances.
It's only money, Dutch. Not like you ain't got any more where that came from. Bill Pickens jibes, now that he has given up himself.
Pick on somebody else, Pickens.
Nah, that wasn't even funny the first time. And the first time was back in 29. Dutch laughs.
After two decades, you still don't get it.
If I may, gentlemen. Primly, Lefty Baxter tosses his cards down with Bill's. He catches a look from Triplehorn.
You need respectful silence before you toss your hand?
Just wanted to make sure you knew where I stood.
The bigger man laughs.
Whatever you say, Lefty. It's just you and me, Dutch. Gollum.
Bud has no expression on his face as he puts down a pair of eights. His bluff called. The full house Dutch displays, grinning, is more than enough to win the small pot.
You almost had me, Bud, if it helps ease the pain, Annie.
The starting pitcher for the Boston Braves snorts and gathers the cards as Dutch gathers his winnings. Bill Pickens, shortstop, laughs after taking a drag of his cigarette.
Seems like that famous Triplehorn luck might be getting a little dim, sonny boy.
Bud looks up, a dangerous glint in his eye.
You shut your trap, Pickens.
What'd I say?
Dutch leans back in his chair, keeping an eye on both, hoping nobody will get tossed out the door into the January snow.
Yeah, just take it easy, youngins. We're all in here in the nice warm clubhouse. Our ball team's going all the way to the series this year, and everything's going to be fine, right?
Lefty, usually found covering the Braves' second base, coughs and looks at his cards.
Let's hope so.
Bud says a lot because he doesn't say anything. Every man at the table is thinking the same thing, and it doesn't need to be said aloud. Which doesn't stop Bill Pickens from saying it, because he has to say something.
I gotta wonder what the chances are for the Braves this year, huh? Bud's still packing heat, for sure, and I didn't mean anything just now, you know, just fooling. But we haven't got the hitting power, and I just don't know, you know?
Dutch Catan, third base and a solid hitter to boot, doesn't look up from his cards.
Shut up, Pickens.
Well, come on. Do we really have a chance of even making the pennant? How long has it been since the Braves even went that far?
Nobody answers. Silence reigns for several hands until Bud raises his chin, looking Pickens, Catan, and Baxter in the eye in turn.
Yeah, which Braves were you mentioning, Bill? That one ball team, the National League certified since 1903 Boston Braves?
His gaze is at once strong and steely.
We pull together, we show this league the best baseball anybody's ever seen, and this year will be like no other. World Series, boys. Believe in it.
They want to. They all want to. But nobody backs up Bud's courageous words. The men return to their cards and their silence for a while longer. Until they start talking about the past, about the former years of glory, like always.
How's about that Grand Slam in 41, huh? Has it been that long? Doesn't seem like it. Jack Carter used to play shortstop. Didn't know him for a hitter much, but that day, amazing hitting it was.
I remember. Seems just like yesterday. Raise you a quarter.
Now, that's high stakes again, bud. I fold. Nothing surprising about that, Pickens. Nothing surprising about that.
And the game goes on. And I think that's going to do it. You know, I want to do chapter one. I do. But I don't remember how long chapter one is. And I do remember that a lot of things happened. So it'll be a short podcast this time around. but we're well begun. And sure, why not? Because I can make the podcast a little longer by saying this. So I might not remember to talk about it in future episodes. Just in terms of my writing process, if that interests anyone, I kind of surprised myself. I like, when I'm writing a book, I like the beginning to be also the end. The beginning is the end and is the beginning kind of a thing. And so as far as this book goes, that prologue with the lady on the train station, you will see her again. In fact, you haven't really even met her yet. That word for word, what I did in the prologue before we got to the guys playing cards, is at the end, and you'll get to find out then what happens. And by then, you have much more context for the scene as a whole. And it's been 7 years since I finished the last book that I was writing. Shoot, maybe longer than that. But yeah, I guess it's been more like nine. Anyway, and I had myself in my memory that most of those nine books had beginning is the end is the beginning kind of things. And I went back and I looked, and I actually think only three, maybe four of them did, which is not most by any standard. So that's really random and doesn't have anything to do with anything, except that kind of proves my point that I don't remember things all that well. So I wasn't kidding when I said that even though I wrote this book, I wrote every one of the words you just heard, and we're only four pages into 200. I'm going to be surprised by some of the things that are coming up. Apparently, it's a Christian book. I did not even remember that. So, yeah. Hopefully, it'll be worth listening to. Appreciate you being along for the ride. And whatever stage you have this week, own it, please. But just to circle back to the beginning, because, like I said, I like doing that. What I had to say earlier about small kingdoms, I was not talking about yours necessarily, but if what I said sounded familiar, if it resonated with you, if any part of you is like, I'm far too easily satisfied, please do something about that. Because too many people are. In fact, I'd say most people are. In fact, I'd say 85, 90, 95% of everybody far too easily satisfied. And I am saying I'm in that other 5%. I'm not saying that being in that other 5% makes me better than, new, or more special than, or more loved than. God loves everybody, whether they care or not. And the day I gave him my keys, he didn't love me more. But I love him more. I love him so much more. And I love life so much more. I love other people so much more. I am so much more available to love other people. It's night and day different, folks. So, if you are far too easily satisfied, what are you going to do about that? I'll give you a couple weeks to think about it. And we'll see you back here then. So long.